Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. This is Dr. Dawn Motika, your host of an hour of medical news, discussion, science, and healthcare in the news, and also answers to your questions, and that would be phone calls and emails. So stay tuned and welcome. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let me start with a health advisory that I think is extremely important. This is an association that has just been investigated. It's a study published. You can look it up. The author is Dr. Jennifer Niebel, N-I-E-B-Y-L. But it's extremely important because it's about proton pump inhibitors, which are over-the-counter medications. The one that we're talking about that's over-the-counter is brand name Prilosec. This study suggests that women who use proton pump inhibitors in the first trimester of pregnancy are at increased risk for giving birth to babies with heart defects. The three heart defects are ventricular septal defects, left ventricular defects, and right ventricular defects. These are increased in women using proton pump inhibitors. It is a large study. It was published, and I do not have the reference. Anyway, it's for women who are listening, who know women who use these drugs. Basically, if you might get pregnant and keep the baby, you probably do not want to be on this. The heart and its structures are fully formed by 6 weeks of pregnancy, and most of us don't know that we're pregnant at 6 weeks. So very important, I think, to avoid proton pump inhibitors if you were seeking pregnancy or would accept a pregnancy. Alternatives which have been shown to be safe include Reglan, which is a prescription drug, but quite inexpensive, and that can be used for heartburn, and it's very effective for gastroesophageal reflux. Other drugs that are perhaps not quite as safe would include the H2 blockers like Zantac and Tagamet, and I wouldn't recommend those for first trimester pregnancy. Antacids, the old standby, totally safe. So antacids and Reglan for your GERD, not proton pump inhibitors, and extremely important information, I think. New and fairly solid data about an increased risk. Let me talk about something that was a press release from the International Alzheimer's meeting. This was quite a big news story yesterday, and it even was on the NewsHour on PBS. And I was struck by the amount of push from the Alzheimer's Association to try and expand the definition of Alzheimer's into people with so-called preclinical disease. Now, I have a real problem with this because it creates a person with disease status. If we start telling people, well, you don't have Alzheimer's, but you're probably going to have it in 10 years, I don't see that we've benefited that individual. The reasoning, I believe, from the Alzheimer's Association is that we're somehow going to push drug manufacturers harder if they see what a big cohort they've got. And I think that's nonsense. I think that the pharmaceutical companies are pushing as hard as they can to find Alzheimer's drugs. Unfortunately, the drugs they found haven't proved to be particularly effective or useful. And I don't think you're going to push them any harder by increasing the cohort. And I think you're going to do a great deal of damage by putting people in that cohort. Not to mention the fact that the biomarkers that they're talking about using to screen people for Alzheimer's include very expensive PET scans of the brain and testing done of the cerebral spinal fluid. So now we've got two harms. We've got doing a spinal tap on someone to screen them for pre-markers of a disease, and we've got the fact that if we tell them that they've got the pre-markers, we don't have any solid therapy for that, and we've just created a person with a disease and really messed up their quality of life to no good end. So bad idea, just totally bad idea. And one of the points that Charlie made to me last night at the dinner table that I wanted to share with you about this is, yes, we really have dinner table conversations in my household. Anyway, one of the things that he said that I think is really a good point, is that not everything needs a drug. And the idea that, well, we shouldn't test for it because we don't have any drugs, that's not what I'm saying. We shouldn't test for it because we can't benefit the person. And we don't always need to have a drug for everything. There are other types of therapy that can probably delay the onset of Alzheimer's. There are psychological therapies and there are stress reduction, treating just diabetes and glucose intolerance are two things that have solid data that they delay or slow the progression of Alzheimer's. So let's put our energy at taking care of inflammation and improving lifestyle. And oh, by the way, another thing scientifically proven to slow the cognitive decline, exercise. Just getting out and walking every day, or running if you can do it, or biking or swimming, raises your levels of nerve growth factors. These are chemical signals in the brain that make neurons grow. This is good. You can do this. Go out and exercise. If you've got a family history of Alzheimer's, get out and walk every day. That's something you can concretely do. And I don't think I need to do a spinal tap on you to prove that. And we've had a caller waiting that whole time, so we're going to go straight to Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Gee, I forgot what I was going to call about. Just kidding.
Okay. Good one.
Cholesterol question real quick, and then another one related. For a geezer-type guy, what would a decent cholesterol reading be?
I'm sorry, you said for a geezer-type guy?
Yes.
Okay, well, it has to be taken in context, and so let me walk you through it. I don't look at cholesterol number at all anymore. I look at low-density lipoprotein, LDL.
Okay.
And there I'm wanting an LDL always below 160. And then if you have any risk factors, which I'll cover in a second, below 130. So one risk factor is being over 50. Another risk factor is being a guy. So I'm guessing that you have two risk factors minimum. So
well,
that
I'm taking a couple of drugs.
So you need to be under 130.
Well, that's going to be impossible. So let's go to the next question.
No, under 130 for LDL is totally possible. You can just do that with diet. Most people can. They just don't want to. Diet and exercise, unless you have genetic variation, if you're eating a good diet, you can get down below 130. Now, if you've got diabetes or high blood pressure, those are also risk factors. And if you've got diabetes or you've ever had a stent or some kind of cardiac event, we want that LDL below 100. That's difficult to do with diet and exercise. And most people, if our target's under 100, I'm sitting down with them saying, okay, for you, a statin meets the risk-benefit checklist, and you probably want to be on that.
Okay. My dietary guideline is, if it looks good, feels good, tastes good, I can't have it. I've been pretty Spartan in my diet, and I've been getting plenty of exercise. And I've been taking red yeast rice and doubling up on fish oil and flax oil.
All right. And so you still have a bad cholesterol doing
well,
all of that?
Well, my total was 185.
And that's on your LDL?
No, that's total.
Oh, total cholesterol 185 is good, but what's your LDL? That's the real number you need to look at.
I do not remember that, but my HDL was something like 57.
Okay. So those are good numbers. If you take the 185 and you divide it by the 57, you get a number of about 3. That's called your risk ratio.
Okay, so that's a good number.
That's a good number. That ratio of total cholesterol to good cholesterol is good. And I'm guessing if you do the math, 185 minus 50, you're already down to 135. And bets are that your LDL is below 135.
Oh, okay.
So I think you're good.
Okay, so my problem is I've always been arithmetically challenged.
That's your problem.
I apologize for taking your time, but thank you for the answers.
Robert, you're a poster child. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk to Bruce in Santa Cruz. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to the program.
Yes, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
This is a follow-up for last week. I want to thank you for your comments about this factor 2 deficiency, and it's gotten me a long way down the road toward getting ready for this appointment. Just had a couple quick follow-up questions that I thought would flesh this thing out.
Sure.
Number one is factor 2 mutation increases the clot risk, and we had this conversation about Coumadin versus antiplatelet drugs, and I'm wondering, kind of like the difference between calcium channel blockers and beta blockers, why we really care where we interrupt the clot risk. Coumadin does it by, you know, inhibiting the clotting cascade. The antiplatelet drug tries to interfere elsewhere. Why do we really care there?
Well, I think that's a fair question, because the clotting cascade is triggered by the platelets. And so if you take the platelets out of the game or slow the platelets down, right, then you're affecting all clotting and you don't start the cascade rolling. Now, with the factor two deficiency, or the factor two mutation rather, that's something that's breaking down clots. And so you've got a slowdown of your breakdown. So it's a race, and it's going to play out differently in different people, mm-hmm, and differently in different diseases. You can't really predict it theoretically. What you have to do is go and experiment on a cohort to figure that kind of a question out. And not being a specialist at that level, I don't know what the experiments in the cohort tell us, but I do know that there will be a evidence-based piece of advice here in terms of which is the better way to go.
Okay.
All right? And I don't know what it is, but you could look it up. It'll be there.
The other thing was, can clots break off and tumble along as emboli and cause CVAs, or do they only break off and tumble along and cause TEs or DVTs?
No, they can cause
a clot.
I have a couple patients who actually have a little hole in their heart, totally harmless thing, and then they got atrial fibrillation and ended up with a stroke. I have other patients who got a blood clot in their leg, which ordinarily wouldn't give you a stroke, but because they had the hole in their heart, the blood clot in their leg, instead of going to the lung, went through the middle of the heart. And so the question is, it depends on where they originate. If they originate on the sort of venous side, the clots are likely to end up filtered out by the lungs, unless they cross the heart, because they can. If the clots start on the arterial side or in the heart, then the first big capillary bed that we care about is the brain.
Right.
So that's your issue.
And why would there be different recommendations if the prior CVA is thrombolytic as opposed to embolic?
Well, because the thrombolytic CVAs are coming from your neck, okay, and they behave differently than the embolic CVAs that come from the heart.
I guess I just presume that we might have had narrowing of carotid artery as a result of the atherosclerotic disease. Then you have an embolus that tumbles along and gets stuck in that narrowed hose.
Yes, but also what can happen is you can form a clot right at the carotid, or the plaque in the carotid can tear and erode, and then it tries to clot off and it forms little emboli, and those act like embolic strokes.
Right.
So there's multiple different ways that a carotid plaque can give you a stroke.
Uh-huh.
So okay. I hope that clarifies it for you.
Very close.
All right.
Do you have time for one more question, or are we done?
One more question, okay.
Okay. Do I understand the literature correctly that factor two mutation in and of itself doesn't increase the risk for a stroke? It just increases the risk for DVT or PEs?
That assumes a person has clear carotids. If you've got clean carotids, that's true.
Okay.
If you don't have clean carotids, I would guess that it doesn't. It's not true, because now you've got a likelihood of more clot happening in the neck.
Right. I'm with you. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We had an off-air question. I have chronic pain in my lower back when I sit down. Physical therapy helps me walk without pain, but it doesn't help when sitting. This person had a normal MRI of the spine, and they want to know, can they have sciatica with a normal MRI? Yes, if you have pain running down the back of your leg and it goes past the knee, it's probably sciatica, and that means that the nerve is being irritated somewhere along its path. Most commonly, we think of sciatica in association with a ruptured disc, but if you have a normal MRI, you don't have a ruptured disc, and you don't have arthritis at the foramen, which is where the nerve comes out of the spine. But there's another place that's fairly common where people can irritate the nerve, and that's the piriformis muscle, which is a muscle that is a rotator of the hip, and it's a deep muscle. It's deep to your butt. And the sciatic nerve actually comes out between the two heads of this piriformis, P-I-R-I-formis muscle. And it's shaped like a little pyramid, hence the name. This will sometimes go into spasm and squeeze the sciatic nerve. And by the way, that'll be worse when you're sitting. So I'm thinking that it's a good possibility that this off-air caller might have piriformis syndrome. There are some specific physical therapy exercises and stretches that should be tried. Take that up with the physical therapist, but that's a better reason to have sciatica than a ruptured disc. Let's go to Owen in Carmel. Hello, Owen.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a blockage of the carotid artery. I have a blockage, and I've been taking Coumadin. And I saw a couple of doctors. They said, you should really be on Plavix. And I don't know, the Coumadin seems to be working, but they felt it wouldn't help with the blockage.
Right. You know, when you say that Coumadin seems to be helping, what you mean is you haven't had another stroke, right?
I haven't had a stroke at all.
Haven't had a stroke at all. Okay. And you know that you've got carotid blockage because you had an ultrasound?
Yeah, right.
And do you know what percentage blockage?
Yeah, about 50.
About 50. Okay. So you haven't had a stroke. You've got a 50% carotid blockage, which is a small amount of blockage. Is there any other reason for you to be on a blood thinner like Coumadin? Like you've had a deep venous thrombosis, or you've had thrombophlebitis, or you've had a pulmonary embolism, anything like that?
I'm going to have to look all those words up.
Well, basically, blood clot
no,
in the leg.
I haven't.
Have you had a blood clot in the leg? No?
No.
Okay. So when you were put on Coumadin, it doesn't actually make sense to me. So there's two possibilities. Either it is overkill, or there's some part of your clinical history that you're not familiar with and you're not telling me that justifies the use of that drug. So
I think I have to gain by not telling you. And
what I'm saying is you may not be aware of it.
Pretty aware of it. I had a pretty good heart specialist down there.
Okay. Well, I don't understand why you're on Coumadin is what I'm saying. And the literature doesn't support the use of Coumadin for the prevention, primary prevention of stroke in a person with a 50% carotid blockage. And the risk-benefit for the risk of hemorrhage from the Coumadin is significant, and the actual benefit in terms of stroke prevention compared to not being on Coumadin is not impressive. So I'm kind of going to side with the most recent two doctors you saw that said, yeah, Plavix might be for you. Now, a certain percentage of people can't use Plavix, and there's a blood test that we do nowadays to look for a mutation, because if you have this mutation, then Plavix won't work for you.
So what does Plavix do exactly? Does it's it an take an, it's away an, the blockage?
It's an antiplatelet drug. So what Plavix does is it takes those little platelets, which are little tiny cells floating around in your bloodstream, and the platelets are going to jump on any clot, block it with their bodies. They basically turn into a lump. As soon as there's any tear in the bloodstream, any protein comes in contact with the blood, the platelets in the blood just jump on the protein like a bunch of guys tackling on a football field. And they do a pileup, and then they start to cross-link, and they ooze out protein, more protein, and this protein triggers the blood clotting cascade, which is the factor one going down this big ramp of mucho proteins turning into a big protein mesh that's kind of like a Brillo pad, and that's the clot. And once that Brillo pad forms, little bits of it can jump off and go to your brain. And so the way that a stroke happens for you would be that the plaque in your carotid artery breaks open and reveals a little protein to the bloodstream. And plaques are stiff, so they crack. And then that protein triggers the platelets, and the platelets trigger the clot, and then the clot breaks off and goes to the brain, and bingo, you've got a stroke. So what they're trying to do with the Coumadin is they're interrupting it further on, downstream. So the clot isn't, the Brillo pad's not forming, but the platelet pileup is. And with the Plavix, you're slowing down the platelet pileup in the first place. And we have data that shows that you can reduce stroke in certain kinds of situations by using Plavix. There's other situations where it doesn't work, and it's a complicated issue and needs to be individualized. But
well,
I would
a blood test that shows that? Is that
well, we need to make sure the Plavix would work for you. And I just, like I said, I'm not understanding why you were put on Coumadin in the first place. That doesn't make sense to me. And when something doesn't make sense to me, it's not usually because you had a bad doctor. It's usually because there's a piece of information that I don't have that explains it. So I hope that's been helpful. I know it's not a firm answer, but it's as firm as it's going to get.
I had an arrhythmia in the heart, and they said that blood might form underneath.
Ah, see? The plot thickens. So they put you on this maybe because you had atrial fibrillation, and that's an irregular heartbeat where the top part of the heart is quivering rather than pumping. So where the heart is quivering, the blood is stagnant, and you can get a clot forming.
Well, I have a pacemaker that's supposed to stop that.
A pacemaker won't necessarily stop atrial fibrillation. It can. It depends on the kind of pacemaker they've put in. But, you know, like I said, there's specific details in each individual's case. We know, for example, that Plavix doesn't prevent strokes if your strokes are coming from the heart. So if the little clots are breaking off from the heart, Plavix doesn't work for that.
Oh, I see.
And so we use the Coumadin in that situation.
I see. Wow.
It's complicated, as I said. And in general, there is a reason, and I think that's probably the reason, but if you're no longer in atrial fibrillation, that's easy to figure out. Then many people would say that you don't need the Coumadin.
Yeah, I don't think I have the fibrillation anymore.
Well, you've got two doctors looking at you recently saying that maybe you should switch to Plavix. I think you should consider their advice.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. I want to read this from last week. Ruth in Santa Cruz wrote me about a Sentinel article about the evils of sunscreen, as she put it. There's an article in the Sentinel. I'd like to hear your level-headed analysis. I'm a former redhead who works outdoors. I need to be out in the sun, and I've been depending on sunscreen to protect me. And the article in question was written by Jennifer Parrish, and it's from a column, it looks like, called Go Green. What Ms. Parrish talks about is whether or not sunscreen is useful. She does a nice critique of the issues. So let me start with premise number one. The International Agency for Research on Cancer has stated that the use of sunscreen can prevent sunburn and decrease the risk of developing squamous cell carcinoma, the most common form of skin cancer, yet may actually increase the risk of developing deadly melanoma. And the report is quoted here, several relevant epidemiologic studies have shown significantly higher risks for melanoma in users of sunscreen than in non-users. Okay. So there are a couple of points about this that I want to make. First of all, if you are fair-skinned, you will have a tendency to use more sunscreen because you're trying to avoid getting sunburned, which hurts. And if you don't burn easily, then that's because you make melanin, which is protective against cancer, readily. And so you will have less sunscreen use. So when you talk about epidemiologic studies, there's a built-in selection bias that has to be accounted for. Now, that being said, the relevant studies in people who are all at high risk for melanoma do show an inverse correlation. In other words, the people who get a second melanoma, we know they're at high risk because they've already had one. The people who get a second melanoma are more likely to get a second melanoma if they're very, very strict about their sunscreen. Now, that sounds paradoxical, but it really isn't. Because the risk of melanoma, if you've already had melanoma, tracks with your vitamin D level. We know that vitamin D is acting as a hormone in the body, and it's turning on some very, very significant anti-cancer switches in the DNA. So if you don't have high levels of vitamin D, which you might not have if you are a religious user of sunscreen and don't supplement, then you may actually be making your risk higher. Now, that's complicated, and it doesn't really come out in this column. Secondly, according to the FDA, the sun protection factor claims on many sunscreen products may be exaggerated. As the FDA states, there's no assurance that the specific values themselves are, in fact, truthful. And most people don't apply enough sunscreen to adequately protect themselves. And this is from Environmental Working Group, which I think is a very legitimate source of information. Quoting, in real life, people apply only one-half to one-fifth the amount of sunscreen used in the laboratory tests. And then they're doing a linear thing. They're saying if it's SPF 30 and you only apply a quarter as much as it's used in this test, then it's only SPF 2. But, you know, this is a nice comparator, and I do think we get a little crazy on the SPF thing. Did you get a burn? Did you get a color change on your skin? You were out for 2 hours, okay? Did it work or did it not work? You're going to know the answer to that as far as later on, did I use enough sunscreen? So we have our own little biological assay called our skin that tells us whether our sunscreen's working or not. Now, one thing that was in this Jennifer Parrish column that I do think is a serious issue as far as sunscreens being actively dangerous is the idea that certain sunscreens may, in absorbing the ultraviolet light, generate free radicals. If they let go of those free radicals and they dump into the skin, you know, that could actually be an issue as far as triggering mutagenesis. And that's important. But again, if that were the case, then we would see more squamous cell carcinoma in sunscreen users, and we don't. We actually see less. So I'm not sure that you can make the case that there's direct mutagenesis. What does worry me is a comment about retinoic acid, which is essentially a form of vitamin A. The ingredient retinyl palmitate is in many sunscreens. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because I know that vitamin A in a topical form is actually photosensitizing. When we use Retin-A for acne, we have to warn people about not being out in the sun, because it actually will increase the risk of sunburn, and it's known to be increasing the risk of mutagenesis, that messing up the DNA in the cells, and we know that from studies. And the article here by Jennifer Parrish goes on to quote these studies showing that when you give retinol palmitate cream and you put it on lab animals and then you subject the lab animals to carcinogenic amount of ultraviolet light, you see increases in the skin cancer. And that actually is an absolute fact. So I'm like scratching my head about what retinol palmitate is doing in sunscreen. And I really don't know. Maybe a preservative or an antioxidant. But I went and checked my cupboard, and three out of the five sunscreens that I had at my house had retinol palmitate in them. And I'm personally going to select sunscreens in the future that don't have it, even though I'm not sure at the amount, because it was way at the bottom of the ingredient list, I'm not sure at the amount that it's in my sunscreen that it actually represents a true risk. Nevertheless, I think it doesn't have to be there, so why subject myself to any potential risk when I'm trying to lower my risk? So ultimately, should you use sunscreen? Yeah, you should. You should avoid getting sunburn. I like the sunscreens that are less chemical. You can't make a chemical-free sunscreen, but the ones that have zinc or titanium micronized, I think, are a better choice. There are data on the safety of all of these things, and I think it's important that we demand from our government better health and safety testing than we're currently getting. I want to talk about that, segue over to a bill that is going before the Senate. And this is called the Safe Chemicals Act. It's been introduced by Senator Frank Lautenberg. And this is the Safe Chemical Act of 2010. We have a link to information about this and the text of the act on our website. And it requires manufacturers to develop and submit a minimum data set for each chemical that they produce. And it gives the EPA actual authority, not the FDA, mind you, but the EPA, full authority to request additional information to determine the safety of a chemical. This is going to allow the EPA to actually take fast action to reduce chemicals that we already know are dangerous, but right now the EPA doesn't have the regulatory authority it needs to pull things from the market. It also creates a, and this is, I think, wonderful, I'm really looking forward to this, a public database to catalog the information submitted by the chemical manufacturers and give us better access so that we can look things up, we can cross-correlate, and we can make our own decisions as consumers about what products to buy. We're not just talking about skincare products here or foods or drugs. We're talking about fire retardants and the stuff that goes into your carpeting and other aspects of our environment, air fresheners. There's something like 50,000 new chemicals in the environment since World War II. And most of us are carrying blood levels. I read recently that Bill Moyers got tested and they found 87 different chemicals in his body that are all new to nature molecules that are present in traceable amounts. And we don't know what most of this stuff does. Not only do we not know what it does in the individual situation, but we have no concept, and I might add, no way really to test what it does in combination. So we need to stop this colossal uncontrolled experiment on our population in the name of, I don't know, corporate profit, expediency. We should all bias towards the old proven chemicals, the stuff that grows on the planet, is going to be safer than the stuff that's created in the lab on the average. Let's go to Allison's question. This is Allison in Santa Cruz. I've been prescribed Premarin cream for vaginal dryness. I'm postmenopausal with a uterus, and I just finished reading the side effects, and I'm a bit uncertain whether or not to use the cream. Also, am I supposed to use a progesterone cream? The doctor never mentioned this. And then the reason it's been prescribed is that intercourse has become painful. And when a woman is over whatever, mid-50s, when her estrogen levels drop, a process we call menopause, the variation in response of the vagina and the vulva is quite wide. But in some women, that tissue becomes very thin and painful and tender. And a lot of women think they've got a yeast infection and start using antifungal drugs because they're itching. But actually the reason they're itching is that they're just being irritated by soap or products that weren't otherwise bothersome to them, like their fabric softener. But now the skin is so thin, they don't tolerate it well. And of course, when they try to have intercourse, just the actual physical friction of intercourse is painful. And this is a huge quality of life issue for people and needs to be addressed. The easiest way to address it is with vaginal estrogen. And you can get estradiol. 17-beta estradiol is basically chemically identical to what your own body is making. And you can get this in a manufactured cream. The trade name for that is Estrace, but there are generics available. And one can also have the estradiol compounded at any percentage by a compounding pharmacist. And that is another legitimate way to do this. If you're looking for perhaps a cream that is more natural, you can go to a compounding pharmacist with your prescription and they will make up an appropriate strength estrogen cream for vaginal use. And then generally people use it for a couple of weeks to get the tissue back matured and thickened again, and then do a low-level maintenance dose. There are also a film, like a little piece of waxy film that's used as a vaginal insert. And there are rings of plastic that have been impregnated with estrogen that can be placed in the vagina and will work for about 3 months and then need to be replaced. So there's multiple ways of going after this. In general, the amount of estrogen that's used is a very low dose. So it's not enough to stimulate the uterus, which is right next door. My attitude is, if you can't detect levels in the blood and you can't detect breakdown products in the urine and you don't see a significant bump in blood levels or urine breakdown products with the use of vaginal estrogen, then you don't need to worry about causing breast cancer or causing blood clots or any of the risks that you saw there in the package insert, because that package insert is for the chemical Premarin and it's not parsed out according to how much are you using, what's the dosing. That's the same warning that you would get with oral Premarin as you get with the 2 weeks of vaginal Premarin. But realistically, the risks are quite, quite different. Just a quick one out to Robbie in Salt Lake City before we go to our next caller. Robbie wants to know if it's okay to eat grape leaves. Each day in the afternoon salad, I pick 10 or so organic grape leaves off the large vine in the backyard and mix it with a smorgasbord of other veggies. It's local and cheap. Grape leaves are fine. They are edible. They are a good source of resveratrol, actually. So you might be getting some benefit there. Certainly, if you eat it every day, you're probably getting some benefit. If you're sure it's organic and you rinse it off, just in case the next door neighbor is using some nasty pesticide and some of it's floating over onto those lovely grape leaves. But I think it's a completely interesting strategy. And I haven't tried it, but I happen to have a grapevine. So when I get home tonight, I'm having grape leaves and nasturtium, a locally grown salad. We'll see how that tastes. Let's go to Rosalyn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Rosalyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
So I wanted to kind of make a comment about the sunblocks that you were talking about, because I'm an esthetician, and this has been a huge part in kind of playing my role in sunscreen. And I feel like this is somewhat new information that's coming out with, I usually suggest there's some really great mineral sunscreens out there. I know like Color Science, Bare Minerals, 100% mineral makeup lines, they use like the zinc and the titanium dioxide.
Right.
So I've been suggesting that quite a bit, and I use it myself and I absolutely love it because it's more of a sunblock. It's reflecting mm-hmm. UVA, UVB rays away from the skin. But is there anything that we should be, or should we be cautious about zinc oxide or titanium dioxide in any way?
Well, this is controversial, and it has to do with we don't know, and we won't know until we've done it for 10 or 20 years.
Right.
But the nanoparticles that are in the micronized means nanoparticles. So the micronized titanium, like the products you mentioned, I believe are titanium. And when you get the particle that small, there's some concern that it may actually be capable of penetrating the skin and depositing at the basal layer. And if you biopsy, I've used a mineral-containing sunscreen on my face now for, I don't know, 15 years. So if you biopsied the skin of my face and really look for it, you'll find particles of titanium in my skin.
Uh-huh.
And we don't really know if that's okay.
I
kind of made the decision a long time ago with my eyes open, aware of this, that given the devil I know, which is photoaging and skin cancer, which does run in my family, so given that I know I've got a risk and I'm fair-skinned and I don't want to be inside all the time, and I know that the chemicals in sunscreens are, for the most part, either neutral to not that good, and I'm putting something on my face every day and eating some of it, I decided I would take my risk with the nanoparticles, and that's kind of where I am on that.
Me too.
But there is a problem with the nanoparticles, and I do want to emphasize also children's sunscreens, because, you know, we're dipping our babies in sunscreen, and some of those sunscreens actually contain products that are known to be hormone modulators or so-called endocrine disruptors.
Wow.
So you really want to go to the Environmental Working Group or the saferchemicals.org sites, and you really want to go and check out your children's sunscreens, and pregnant women, since you're an esthetician, you know, mm-hmm. those are the people who really need to be careful about what they're putting mm-hmm. on their body.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. So I think we're in agreement. Any other comments or questions?
I guess I've found, because I've been doing a lot of research on it, and most of the moisturizers that claim, you know, that they have SPF 15 or that they have sunscreens in them are the chemical sunscreen, whether it's avobenzone or oxybenzone, and basically it's helping to create free radicals. And then it can also cause hyperpigmentation, and because it's absorbing either the UVA, UVB rays from the sun, so it can create a lot of heat in the skin, which is, you know, can also, if people have rosacea,
stimulates,
can really increase their capillary damage.
You know, living in caves is an option. Wearing a hat
right.
is an option. I want to emphasize that we need the vitamin D, and staying out of the sun between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. is really where the great advantage to avoidance is. And then getting sun earlier or later in the day is a very good idea, I think, for long-term health. And it's less likely to cause photoaging and less likely to cause cancer, because the light photons are attenuated. They aren't as powerful, so they don't just blast through the DNA like a bowling ball through a bunch of pins the way that the higher energy rays that happen in the middle of the day do. So that's another mm-hmm. strategy for people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Sandy in Gilroy. Hello, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have, I'm 56. I have very severe osteoporosis. I've been on Actinol and Fosamax for about 7 or 8 years. Had one severe break in my leg. I have low vitamin D levels. And so right now I'm on 3,000 units of vitamin D a day. And my teeth are extremely loose. You can hear in my voice a little bit of a lisp because I've had them beefed up. And I'm really concerned about what I should do. Should I stay on the Actinol? Do I have a fuzzy jaw happening?
No, I don't think that's the teeth being loose are mm-hmm. necessarily your issue. The osteonecrosis that you hear about is really an advanced infection, and it's kind of tooth decay, and it would seem more likely to me that the reason that you have the loose teeth is because you've got a lot of bone loss.
Right.
Now, you've been checked for hyperparathyroid syndrome?
Not really.
I think I
should get to an endocrinologist.
Yeah. Well, either that or a sophisticated primary care doctor who knows to do the testing. But vitamin D levels, you should be shooting for 65 to 75.
Mm-hmm. And last time I was tested, I was at 30.
Right. Like I said, you should be shooting for 65 to 75. I would definitely do that. I would make sure that I'm taking a form of calcium that's very well absorbed, so something that liquefies easily. The vinegar test, if you're taking a pill, you drop it in vinegar, and 15 minutes later, if it's not powdery, get another pill.
Oh.
Because it needs to break down in your system. And this is particularly true if you're taking antacids or proton pump inhibitors or anything else that's going to...
Nothing else.
Okay. So you need to make sure vitamin D is good. You need to make sure you don't have excess amounts of parathyroid hormone. By now, you've been on the Fosamax long enough that you should think about a drug holiday. There's a risk. You need to let the bones remodel. Mm-hmm. And we've been seeing these unusual femur fractures. And they're now starting to pick up what to do in terms of testing for them. But you need to get a longer x-ray of the hip than we usually get. We don't get the x-ray going down low enough. Mm-hmm. This is a mid-femur fracture, which is very unusual. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see those go up with people who are long-term users of Fosamax because we're blocking all of their remodeling. And so they're getting essentially thickening of the bone, and the bone gets thick but unstable.
Oh.
There's thickening, and there's also a little beak, they're calling it. It's a little bit of calcium that forms where the stress fracture is trying to heal itself just before the femur lets go. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be starting, I think, to screen women who are long-term Fosamax users or Actonel mm-hmm. or any mm-hmm. of the bisphosphonates, really.
Okay.
And it's a bit scary because mm-hmm. what do I do? And one thing you do is you think about a SERM temporarily, switching mm-hmm. over to Evista, which is a raloxifen. It's a selective estrogen receptor modulator, or going on estrogen, or another drug, an injectable drug called Forteo, F-O-R-T-E-O, which has a completely different mechanism of action and is used in, now it's used in people who have been on a bisphosphonate and fracture anyway.
Okay.
So non-responders. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't surprise me, and if I were a gambler, I would be buying stock in this company because it's an expensive drug and it won't go off patent for 10 years. Yeah, I know. Great, right?
Maybe I don't have to work anymore.
Well,
eventually.
I don't know. You'll have to buy stock in the company.
Yeah.
But that is going to become, I believe, a more common therapy as the limitations of the bisphosphonates become more apparent. I think it's time to do a drug switch.
Okay. Thank you. One other quick question. It was my understanding that this summer they were going to the recommended daily use of vitamin D was going to be reevaluated.
Yes.
And right now they're saying 800 units or 400 units a day, but is 3,000 a day too much?
No. There are people taking insane amounts. You know, there's always people who are going to be out there on the fringe. Uh-huh. But I'm grateful for them because they become the guinea pigs. And I've had people taking 20,000 units a day.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is way too much, in my opinion. You're out there on the cutting edge and potentially going to get yourself toxic. However, endocrinologists have been using 50,000 a week for a long time. I'll put people on 5,000 a day if I find them deficient, and then in a couple of months, I'll recheck them. You need to look at people whose vitamin D doesn't go up. When you give them vitamin D at, say, 5,000 a day and they don't go up on their blood levels, that's a sign of inflammation. They may, because of the inflammation in their body turning on a different set of chemicals, they're turning their 25-hydroxy vitamin D into 1,25-hydroxy. And what that does at high levels is it interferes with your ability to fight off cancer. So there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. Blood levels need to be monitored with high-dose vitamin D therapy, not 800 units, but 8,000 units. In that circumstance, I believe we can do a lot of good for people and modulate their risk factors for all sorts of things, including autoimmune disease, but mm-hmm. osteoporosis for sure.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. A lot of information.
Yes, and you can listen to it again, just to be sure you got it all, by going to the website, mm-hmm. askdrdon.com, and you can listen to the programs, even old programs, on there. There's a lot on osteoporosis that you might find interesting.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Another email, this one from John in Monterey, rather topical. I have what looks like a nasty insect bite 3 inches under my armpit. After a couple of weeks, it's finally healing, but it only occurred to me recently it could have been the result of a tick. By the time I examined the raised area closely, about a week after it appeared, there was no tick. I didn't notice the famous red ring around the area, but then again, I didn't pay much attention to it for several days. So what should I do now? I'd rather not go through a course of antibiotics if it's not necessary. John, you absolutely are right. Don't go through a course of antibiotics because you might have been bitten by a Lyme tick. That's not a very sensible thing to do. if a person has a tick and it stays on their body for 24 hours and they are exposed because the tick contains Lyme disease, and, you know, there's surveys of what is the frequency of Lyme disease ticks in different parks, and there's a lot of variability. I mean, in Nicene Marks here in Santa Cruz County, the tick infection rate is much higher than in other parts of California. So on the average, it's 4% in the state of California, but in certain little pockets, it's much higher, as you'd expect. But even then, the tick has to be on your body for a long time. And people get exposed to Lyme disease and don't get sick. It doesn't make sense to treat with antibiotics just for a tick bite. If one of my patients gets a flu-like illness and a fever, or they see that bullseye kind of rash, then I will treat with antibiotics, and I think that's an appropriate compromise. You don't usually get Lyme disease from the tick bite without having some acute symptomology. So if you're watchful and check your temperature, that's really good enough. And so I would say at this point, you're living in an area with ticks. If you develop symptoms of joint pain or achiness, if you develop a Bell's palsy, some sort of unusual neurologic syndrome, then those are the times that it would be wise to say to the doctor, you know, there are a lot of ticks where I live. Could this possibly be a manifestation of Lyme disease? And let the doctor decide to do the testing at that time when you're actually showing some sign that you might actually have something. So I hope that's helpful. Let's go to Karen in Santa Cruz. You recently gave me information on CoQ10 dosages. I've been taking it now for several months and have noticed no ill effects. An acupuncturist wants me to take his herb formulas. I've said no due to the lead content. His claim is that everything has lead in it, including the Q10 I take because it is made in China. Is this true? I'm recovering from statin poisoning. Should I be concerned about the lead content and the accumulative dosage I would supposedly ingest? Thank you for your attention. Karen, let me say that lead is definitely an issue. It's an industrial pollutant. Most of us who are in our... Well, let's see, if you were born before 1972, you undoubtedly have been exposed to lead. Gasoline has lead in it, or used to until quite recently. Dust has lead in it, particularly dust in older houses that were built before they took lead out of the paint. So anyone who's ever lived in a house built before 1972, you've probably been exposed to lead. Now, that being said, lots of exposures. Most of us handle our body burden. It's not wise to be taking substances that might contain lead. And there have been, and continue to be every year, cases of people who actually get clinical lead poisoning from products from overseas. So I have to say that in my practice, I use very few products with lead potentially in them. That means I don't use imported Chinese herbal products. I will recommend using Chinese herbs in the following circumstances. You're purchasing them from a company such as Khan Herbal here in Santa Cruz County, which tests all of the herbs they get for lead and then manufactures the formulas here with safe manufacturing conditions. That, I think, eliminates the lead risk. You have to be sure that at some point on the product line, things are being tested. If the herbs are coming from China as raw herbs, then I'm willing to accept them as long as they're tested once they hit this shore. But a packaged product that's coming wrapped in cellophane from China, I do not recommend. As far as vitamins are concerned, anytime you're buying a vitamin that's being made outside of the country, there is the possibility of lead contamination, and the devil's in the dosing. So there are a number of companies that test every batch, that there are spot checks like what consumerlab.com does. And that's a very good way to figure out, is the product I'm using safe, is to see if it's listed as being validated by that website. And that's like $30 a year to have access to a great deal of information. Plus, you're supporting a very good cause. This is an independent laboratory that runs by subscription only. And they actually go to the store and buy stuff and then test it. And that is absolutely the way to go when you're talking about product safety. So I want to thank everyone who called in with questions and also thank everyone who emailed. We've come to the end of another hour, and I've definitely enjoyed it, and I hope you have as well. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.